Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So in today's episode, I want to talk to you about how to get better sleep. So sleep can be profoundly impacted during perimenopause, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you that. You've probably experienced that already or maybe experiencing it currently. It can be one of the first things that we start to notice as early as even late 30s, particularly early 40s. That's definitely what happened to me, and a lot of my clients, a lot of people I speak to report that as well. It's mostly due in that earlier phase due to the start of progesterone declining, because progesterone is such a sleep supportive hormone. It's very calming. It increases levels of brain chemicals that help to support our sleep, support calm and anti-anxiety. So once we eventually, in early perimenopause, when we start to have more and more menstrual cycles where we either don't manage to ovulate and therefore we don't make progesterone because that's how we make it, or we still do ovulate, but we make less robust levels of progesterone than we used to, then on those particular months, sleep can be a real problem. Never mind when we get to the sort of mid to later stages of perimenopause, when we're having just more and more and more and more months where we're not ovulating or we're just not making enough to any progesterone. So then sleep issues can become more so. And then we also have the, as we go through further through perimenopause itself, estrogen declining is going to impact our ability to sleep. It could impact our anxiety. We can have night sweats that can start to impact, you know, obviously because it's going to wake us up in the night. Sometimes we're going to have to wake up and actually change bed sheets and switch on lights. And, you know, that's extremely disruptive. And then we're just going to have trouble falling back to sleep again. So there can be quite a few things feeding into it. Low progesterone, declining progesterone is definitely one of the first kind of factors that starts to occur, like, as I said, late 30s, early 40s. And it can just become a bit of a vicious cycle as, you know, all the other kind of symptoms that I just mentioned start coming up, then that's just going to have this knock-on impact to sleep. And then our ability to sleep, whether we, if we have a poor night's sleep, that's again going to have an impact on all of the other symptoms. So anxiety would be worse that day, hot flushes, night sweats would be worse after poor sleep, and so on. So it's this vicious cycle, but if we can get a handle on sleep and really understand the fundamentals of how to support it, we can significantly help not only to get better sleep, but also the vicious cycle where a lot of the symptoms are exacerbated by poor sleep. So this is why sleep is one of my four foundational pillars of health when it comes to supporting the body through perimenopause and just generally. So if you remember in previous episodes, I talked about my four foundational pillars being blood sugar balance, sleep, stress management, and then movement and exercise. And these are the four pillars that I work through, the real fundamentals that I work through with every client. They're what I work through inside the Empowered Perimenopause subscription program. You know, obviously I'm talking about them on my podcast. So it's really difficult to get any kind of, I'd say, you know, permanent happy resolution without addressing those pillars. But the beauty of addressing these foundational pillars is if you pull one of these levers, so for example, today we're talking about sleep and aligning the circadian rhythm. If you pull one of these levers after listening to today's episode, for example, it will reverberate throughout the whole body, having this impact, this positive impact on so many different systems. The nervous system, metabolic health, heart health, hormone system, energy production, and so much else, cognitive function, you know, just how we feel on a generally day to day. So although the body, the sort of physiology and the biochemistry is complex, we are complex beings, of course, that's what makes us so amazing. But the things that we need to do to support ourselves isn't complicated. It's not do one thing to support blood sugar, do another thing to support sleep, do another thing to help manage stress. the same kind of set of habits can support all of the different foundations. Obviously, there's nuances here and there, and that's why I'm talking about everything separately. I talked about blood sugar pillar being pillar one in the previous episode last week, which was episode 13. And I'm talking about sleep today. I'm going to talk about the stress pillar next week and the movement pillar the following week. So yes, we talk about them separately, but essentially doing the same kind of set of nutrition and lifestyle habits can pull the lever on all of those different foundational things, and therefore pull the lever positively on so many different systems in the body and just have this reverberating effect impact throughout the body. And that's what's so great about really leveraging, utilizing nutrition and lifestyle interventions to support the body in so many different ways. So let's get into the sleep pillar today. So in order to really understand how to get better sleep, we need to understand our circadian rhythms and their role in our sleep. That is the most fundamental piece. So let me just start by kind of painting the picture that so many of us experience. So it's getting late in the evening, in the night. We know we need to go to sleep, so we go to bed, but we can't fall asleep. Or eventually we fall asleep, but we can't stay asleep. It's just not a restful sleep. And usually we wake up in the morning. If we have managed to, what we think, fall asleep and stay asleep, we just start to wake up in the morning not feeling rested. We may have felt so a few years ago, but now suddenly it's just not a restful sleep. We can't expect our nervous system to just unwind, so that'll be our brain and our stress response system in the body, to just unwind at the click of a finger, just like that. Like possibly, you know, children or babies, like we used to do as well in our 20s and 30s. It was much easier to just get ourselves to bed after a busy day and fall asleep. We cannot expect our nervous system to just unwind at the click of a finger like that anymore. The circadian rhythm doesn't just find its rhythm at night when we ask it to. Our habits from the start of every single day, and then what we continue to do throughout the day and what we do during the evening, all impact our ability to unwind for sleep. It really does start at the beginning of the day. We can't just rock up to whatever, 10:30 at night and say, right, let me just turn the lights down. Let me just brush my teeth and I'm just going to get into bed and out I'll go like a light. That just doesn't work when we move into perimenopause, when progesterone starts to decline, when estrogen is erratic and then subsequently declines later in perimenopause. The changes, the impact that has on our entire hormone system, the whole landscape of our hormones, just makes our nervous system become more, and our circadian rhythm more likely to kind of more sensitive, if you like. It kind of goes out of sync. So we have to train and nurture our body clock and our nervous system throughout the day if we want successful sleep. And light and dark cues are crucial. So light cues in the morning in our brain and dark cues in the evening and going into our brain, because that's the kind of control center of the body, are so important. And the modern world, of course, it's wonderful, all the things that we can do now, you know, like how did we ever live without all the stuff that we've got now, all the ability that we've got to multitask? But although it's so wonderful and it allows us to, just do things we could never have thought possible, you know, many years ago, it allows us to stay constantly connected to people. But that's not necessarily a great thing, allowing us to stay constantly switched on until late at night with the ability to continually check emails. Obviously, watching TV, we've always been able to do, but now we can also check emails throughout the night. We might be in multiple WhatsApp groups with notifications popping off constantly, and we just, we say, I'll check our phone one more time, just one more time, one more time, and then I won't just look at one more message. I'll just check my emails one more time just to see if that so-and-so's replied, and then I'll turn it off. But we never actually do until the very, very last moment. So if this resonates with you, you're not alone. If this is what most people are doing, scrolling for hours through, whether it's social media, YouTube, just online, on the internet, whatever it might be, going down rabbit holes, looking this up, looking that up, that leads to that, one thing leads to another, and you've just been scrolling up until bedtime. Then you think, right, I'll quickly check WhatsApp, I'll quickly check my emails, and let alone maybe you're watching documentaries in the evening about serial killers, which is me. I tend to love these things, scary movies, whatever it might be, plus all of this technology and this stimulation going into our brain. So you've got the blue light coming from the phone or the laptop or the tablet, going straight, emitting blue light straight into our eyes, into our brain, which basically tells the brain it's time to wake up. It's time to make cortisol. It's time to be alert, versus what it should be doing. What we should be telling our brain during the evening is it's time to wind down. It's time for cortisol to be at its absolute lowest point. And in its place, it's time to make melatonin ready for sleep. But we're just not doing that. We're telling our brain the absolute opposite of that. And it's just doing what we're asking it to do. So this is just all of this, you know, ability to do all of this stuff, although it's convenient, and being able to multitask all through the day, just keep going. All of the stuff that we have to do and be throughout the day for one person is usually a lot. It's killing our nervous system. It's killing our body clock, and it's killing our sleep. So what we need to understand is that the state of our nervous system during the day impacts our ability to fall asleep at night. So more rest, more balance, more. And when I say rest, I don't mean you need to lie down multiple times throughout the day. I just mean more restorative time, more balance throughout the day can create better sleep. And then what we do first thing in the morning. So we're going to have a look at that in a minute. But let me first ask you this question. So when you wake up in the morning, how long does it take you to go from feeling like you're barely conscious to feeling like you're fully awake and you're ready to go, ready to start the day without needing anything to get you going, like caffeine, for example? How long does it take from the moment you wake up to feel like you're fully awake and ready to start? So I'll let you think about that for a second. But the answer should be within 30 to 45 minutes. Sooner the better as well. So preferably 20 minutes. But within 30 to 45 minutes of waking up, you should go from feeling barely conscious, I've just woken up, to I'm fully awake and I'm ready to go. So most of us aren't going to answer within 30 to 45 minutes. Or if we do, it's because we've got out of bed and had a coffee maybe. But let's have a look at what morning, because by the end of this podcast, I want you to be able to answer, you know, I want you to be able to go away and do whatever it is you need to do to get to that answer of it's within sort of 20 to 30 to 45 minutes of waking, I feel alert and ready to go. Or as I said, much sooner than that. Ideally, open our eyes, wake up and go, right, oh, okay, wake up, I'm ready to go. So within sort of 5-10 minutes would be ideal. So let's talk about what morning daylight has got to do with sleep and how you feel when you wake up in the morning and how, you know, how you've slept the night before. So first of all, I'll talk about what I mean by circadian rhythm and body clock. So your circadian rhythm is the light and dark cycle. So light being sun, daylight, dark being nighttime, darkness. The circadian rhythm is the light-dark cycle that regulates loads of important functions in the body, including immunity, heart health, brain health, mood health, metabolic health. So many different things are regulated by a healthy circadian rhythm. When this sleep-wake cycle, that's what your circadian rhythm is, circadian being like day, basically, when this 24-hour, roughly 24-hour sleep-wake cycle clock is out of alignment, it can lead to quite significant sleep issues and insomnia. Now, there's two hormones that govern this sleep-wake biorhythm, that's cortisol and melatonin. Cortisol is the energy mobilizing hormone. So that's the one that should be at its highest first thing in the morning when we wake up to mobilize us, to get us out of bed and get us going and ready for the day. Melatonin is the opposite of this. It's the sleep hormone. It's also an important antioxidant in the body, but for the purposes of this session, we're talking about it as a sleep hormone. So it is highest, it should be highest at night. Cortisol should be lowest at night, highest in the morning. Cortisol should be lowest at night, and then melatonin takes its place. They're not going to work in tandem. Melatonin will come along instead of cortisol at night to stimulate a good night's sleep, a restorative night's sleep. So misaligned light and dark cues, so that's the light and dark cues that are going into through our eyes, into our brain, the control center of the body. If those light and dark cues are misaligned, so for example, we're not getting the light cue first thing in the morning and we're not getting the dark cues at night, that's going to create havoc in our ability to fall asleep at night and or to stay asleep, usually both. energy production and appetite regulating hormones and metabolism regulating hormones. They also follow circadian rhythms. And so when the rhythm is disrupted, then it can also lead to negative health consequences like cardiovascular health and metabolic health implications. Not to mention symptoms of low energy, fatigue, energy dips, particularly in the afternoon, cravings and dysregulated appetite, mood issues, sleep issues, and weight gain. So lots of issues, lots of consequences of having misaligned light and dark cues. And so, as I just mentioned, all of those things that we're doing at night, checking WhatsApps, emails, scrolling, Instagram, whatever it might be, watching TV, all of that is misaligned dark cues at night. So we're not supposed to have all of that blue light going into through our eyes, to our brain. It's telling, as I said, it's telling the brain, wake up, it's time to make cortisol. So that's a misaligned cue. And the same way in the morning, if we're not getting into natural daylight, as soon as we wake up, ideally within sort of 30 minutes of waking, we're having misaligned light cues in the morning. So we'll talk more about that in a minute. And then enter perimenopause, where female physiology becomes even more susceptible to circadian rhythm dysregulation, because the change in estrogen and progesterone, the decline and the erratic nature of estrogen, means that cortisol naturally goes up. I've talked about that on a previous episode. It's called cortisol something. I can't remember what number it is, but I talk a lot about what happens there. We become naturally more cortisol elevated. So more naturally in that kind of fight or flight response than we would have been before. So and that's going to impact a circadian rhythm anyway. So we really do need to support our circadian rhythm now more than ever. We didn't need to be so, strict, I'm not sure what to say, in our sort of 20s and earlier 30s when it comes to the light and dark cues. Ideally, we should always be, but we wouldn't have been as sensitive to the misaligned light and dark cues back then. But as soon as we're in perimenopause, so late 30s onwards, we have to be looking after our circadian rhythm. And definitely into menopause and postmenopause, when estrogen has essentially left the building, the circadian rhythm is regulated by estrogen. So, that can just make it even more so of an issue. So essentially, the most powerful way to regulate and improve your sleep and your mood and your energy and your weight is to get some full spectrum light exposure for about 5 to 10 minutes within 20 to 30 minutes of waking up. The longer, the better that we can be out in natural daylight. So 5 to 10 minutes, if that's all you can do, great. The longer, the better. I understand that's not always possible for everyone, but we do need to do what we can. So within 20 to 30 minutes of waking up, outside in full spectrum light. We can use, obviously, it's, the clocks have just gone back here in the UK, so it's just going to get darker and darker in the morning soon. And we're going to go into winter. So it's just going to be dark when most people wake up. Most people are waking up, earlier than when the sun rises now in the winter. But we can use a full spectrum light box. So I have two of them. They're called 10,000 Lux light boxes or full spectrum light boxes. I just buy mine from Amazon. They're about £25 to £30. I have one in the bedroom that I switch on as soon as I wake up in the morning. And then I have one in the living room and kitchen that I switch on as soon as I walk into there. So studies show that having being exposed to that, having that full spectrum light or 10,000 Lux light box in front of our eyes for 30 minutes, you don't have to sit and stare at it. But just like you would do when you're outside, you would just be outside, you're exposed to that daylight. You just want that light box around you for 30 minutes first thing in the morning. And then when it is naturally daylight outside, ideally we do go outside as well. But in the summer months, if we can just get straight outside, that's ideal. So if it's your balcony, your garden, or if you can just throw some clothes on, if you work from home, throw some clothes on, go for a walk while sun is up, and then come home and get ready for your day. Whatever you can do is great. And we do need to be either outside in it, or at least if you've got a patio door or a window, you need to be right over there, essentially with the door or the window open and almost like your head sticking out. So studies show that the further away we are from that window, the less of the lux, full spectrum light that we're getting. So the closer we can get to that door, to that window, ideally outside, the better. So your circadian rhythm is called the light and dark cycle because it's literally regulated by your exposure to light in the morning and your exposure to darkness at night. So as I said, if we're not getting that light in the morning and we're also getting loads of blue light exposure at night, so we've got overhead lights on at home, we're on our phones, we're on our tablets, we're on our computers, we're on our TVs, right up to bedtime, that is misaligned light and dark cues. Your circadian rhythm basically responds to light and dark cues that it receives at the appropriate times, morning and evening stroke night. So giving these light and dark cues at the right times is how you keep this really important rhythm in check. So really it's quite simple, but obviously looking at the way we do things might not be simple straight away because you might be thinking, well, what do I do then? Do I just not, am I not allowed to use my phone at night? Like, what do I do? But we'll talk about that more in a moment because it's not that, it doesn't have to be that complicated. So an important aspect of your circadian rhythm to be aware of is something called the cortisol awakening response. We can shorten that to the CAR. So within my industry where I'm talking to clients and colleagues, we call it the CAR, the cortisol awakening response. I've kind of alluded to this already where I said in the morning, cortisol should be at its absolute highest and then it should be at its lowest at night and melatonin takes its place. In the morning, we want to have this high response of cortisol, which is known as the cortisol awakening response. It's the normal healthy rise of the hormone cortisol first thing upon waking. Within about 30 to 45 minutes of waking, it should happen. So cortisol should rise up to a high peak. If we were to say, for example, look at it on a graph, we'd see this like high peak within 30 to 45 minutes of waking up. And then it would gradually just fall throughout the day on this graph, getting to its lowest point at night, which allows you then to make the sleep hormone melatonin instead and fall into a nice deep restorative sleep for the night. So if your answer to the question I asked a minute ago was, I don't feel awake for a few hours or until I've had a couple more of coffee, then we know that your cortisol awakening response, your CAR, it's sluggish and it needs help. You're probably not having one at all, not having a cortisol awakening response at all. So you wouldn't get that peak if we looked at a graph, or you're just getting a really, really, really small one. So it's just not enough. The other end of the spectrum is if you wake up and immediately feel anxious, stressed, panicked, ready to go, like, you know, alert because you're so anxious that you just want to jump out of bed and you're really stressed, then this suggests that your awakening response is too heightened, meaning cortisol is too high and too fast. It rises too fast as soon as you wake up. So there we would want to look at, you know, your stress, what's going on. Is there any stress in the body, like physiologically, for example? But we want somewhere in between, basically. So if you wake up and feel fully awake and ready to go within, say, 20 minutes, then this is really good. If that was your answer to the question, you know, within 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, I feel great. I just feel ready to go. I just get out of bed. I brush my teeth. I get on with my day. That's what we want. So morning light exposure helps you to have a more normalized response. So either way, if you're someone who's got the sluggish response or the other end of the spectrum where you're just immediately feeling anxious and panicked, so your response is too heightened, too fast, we do still want to look. It's just, you know, the same things apply. We want to look at morning light exposure and evening darkness. And then if you're also the person who's waking up feeling anxious, it's too heightened, we also really want to look at, you know, stress management there and see what's going on. So that morning light exposure is a daily habit to master. It really, really is. It has to be. And it's so simple and it's free. And then stress management tools used throughout the day. So when I say that, I mean something really simple, like a 3-minute breathing exercise, the 4-6 breath ratio. I absolutely love it. It's so simple. Breathe into a count of 4, breathe out to a count of 6 through the nose and mouth. Through your belly, not your chest. So that's just a really simple thing that you could just use. That would be a stress management tool, in inverted commas, one of many. We'll talk more about that next week. Just to help calm any heightened cortisol responses that might be happening throughout the day. So morning light exposure, stress management throughout the day, little breaks where you're calming your system, maybe sitting out in nature, walking out in nature, doing, you know, getting out in daylight, just having some time out, even if it's just for a few minutes throughout the day, can then all lead up to much better night's sleep. So here are just some simple ways to get morning light exposure. So let's say you work from home. As I said a minute ago, you could get up. This is what I do in the kind of lighter months, spring and summer, when it is actually daylight when I wake up. Get up, get dressed. Just don't bother showering or anything. Just get dressed and go out for a walk, minimum of 5 minutes within those first 30 to 45 minutes of waking. So ideally, you'll just get up, get dressed and just go straight out, because you want to get the daylight exposure within the first 30 to 45 minutes. But if you can get it sooner, even better. Go out for that walk for a minimum of 5 minutes. My morning walk is about 45 to 50 minutes, depending on how slow or fast I walk. But even just 5 minutes would do. The longer, the better. But anywhere between, let's say, 5 minutes and, you know, up to an hour, whatever you've got. Or if you have a garden, you could go out and do some stretching or some other gentle movement out there. If you can't get outside within those first 30 to 45 minutes of waking, open your window or your patio door, whatever it is you've got, and soak in that morning daylight for at least 5 minutes. If there's no cloud cover or it's sunny, then 5 minutes alone will do. If it's really cloudy, then you'll need 10 minutes outside. If there's real dense cloud cover, like most of the mornings here in the UK, then you'll need 20 to 30 minutes outside. And as I said, if it's still dark when you wake up in the morning, you can buy this full spectrum or 10,000 lux light box. As I said, mine are from Amazon. They cost just under £30. Got one in the bedroom, living room, kitchen. Be in it for half an hour. Just be, you know, have it set up on your counter. Just turn it on while you're getting ready, whether that's in the bathroom or the living room or the kitchen. If you're lucky enough to have some time to yourself in the morning, you know, you're just there making a cup of tea, a cup of coffee or whatever it might be, or getting some water. And then, you know, again, just have it on for the first 30 minutes that you're up and about, basically, whatever you're doing. You could also consider the light-based alarm clocks, like Lumi is one of the most well-known brands here in the UK. They use gradual light to act as your sort of alarm clock, the full spectrum light. It starts lower and then it builds itself up to the 10,000 lux. So that acts as your alarm clock instead of the horrible sound that we have, we tend to have as alarm clocks waking us up, which is a horrible way to wake up. The gradual light can just wake you up more naturally, and you would just set it to go up to sort of raise up to the 10,000 lux within a certain time frame. So you don't risk kind of oversleeping. And then at night, we want to do the complete opposite. So we want to use dim lighting everywhere in the evening. Ideally, you'll have lights that can be dimmed. But if you don't, like me, I don't have dimmable lights in my home, just use soft lamp lighting. So I don't use any overhead lighting after about 7 o'clock. Once we're finished in the kitchen, lights off. And then it's just the soft lamp lighting that we've got around the home. I have a rechargeable dim light in the bathroom for getting ready for bed and brushing teeth. You know, if we wake up in the night and go to the toilet, we just have this very dim sort of like red light that's just enough for us to see what we're doing, but it isn't that full spectrum overhead light that's going to increase cortisol at night when we don't want to do that. So you basically want to avoid overhead bright lights in the evening, especially close to bedtime, and then that blue light emitting from your phone, your computer, your tablet and your TV. You could consider buying some blue light blocking glasses for watching TV in the evenings, which is what I do. Brands that I like are Boncharge or Block Blue Light. Block Blue Light might be a bit cheaper and easier for the UK, but Boncharge is also very good. So you would use these red blue light blocking glasses whilst you're watching TV through the evening, or maybe you are, you know, using your phone for a bit for whatever reason. And then in the hour before you're planning to go to bed and you actually want to fall asleep, you want to avoid all screens, so all blue light and all overhead lighting. So put your phone on flight mode or leave it in another room. You could just read in some dim lighting. That's what I do in the hour before bed. You could do some yin yoga or some restorative yoga poses. You can like Google some lovely yin or restorative yoga poses that specifically help to kind of wind you down in the evening. Or you can do a yoga nidra meditation. It's also known as NSDR, non-sleep deep rest body scan meditation. That can be really lovely to kind of start to set you up for a really good night's sleep. It's a really helpful winding down meditation. And then try to sleep in complete darkness. So using a sleep mask can help to block any kind of light pollution that you might have from anywhere. I find that extremely, like, it's just a game changer for me to use a sleep mask. So your circadian rhythm, that light dark, really does help regulate all of your rhythms, including your hormonal rhythms, and as I said, even your kind of hunger and energy production rhythms as well. So plenty of reasons to support it that go way beyond sleep, but sleep is obviously, as we know, is so crucial for absolutely everything. So other ways, or other, let's say, other reasons for sleep issues that I've already talked about are low progesterone, which disrupts the kind of sleep centers of the brain and can lead to trouble falling asleep, staying asleep. And as I said, low progesterone also increases anxiety. So that can impact your ability to fall asleep as well if you're just lying there with racing thoughts. So even just things like, you know, if you are finding that you're lying there with racing thoughts, obviously we want to look at the root cause. Is it low progesterone? Do we need to support your, if you're at the earlier stages of kind of earlier 40s, do we need to support your ability to ovulate so that you can start to make more progesterone each month? If you're much later in the game of perimenopause, do you want to talk to your doctor about taking body identical progesterone if there's just no progesterone coming in and that's the kind of root cause of your sleep issues? But either way, if anxiety is happening for you at night, you know, simple things like writing down what's going on in your head, the things that you're consistently just you're just constantly lying there thinking about over and over again. If you can get them onto paper, we call it a brain dump. That can be really helpful because it can kind of just help you sort through it. Okay, it's all on paper now. I can let it go. But yeah, maybe even plugging into a yoga nidra meditation that I just mentioned can be helpful as well to help you drift off. But of course, you know, you want to be doing all the things that I just said about aligning your circadian rhythm. Other reasons can be high histamine during the high estrogen phases of perimenopause. So the earlier stage of perimenopause, I've said before that estrogen can rise to 2 to 3 times higher than it's ever been in our life. Also, as part of the estrogen roller coaster, when estrogen is even declining, the high points of that roller coaster can induce histamine, because high levels of estrogen, whether it's just a temporary high or a long-term high, can increase histamine production. Impaired ability to cope with stress due to, again, you know, the shifts in estrogen and progesterone. So as I said, we just become more sensitive to that fight or flight stress response with shifts in estrogen and progesterone. So again, we need to support stress. That's why stress management is one of my foundational pillars. And we'll talk about that next week. And other symptoms that disturb sleep, like hot flushes, increases in bladder frequency, restless leg syndrome, sleep apnea that you may or may not know about, all of which, you know, all of these can be experienced in perimenopause, can then disturb sleep. But the most fundamental thing is to align your circadian rhythm, which will also support the other reasons for sleep issues that I've just mentioned. Okay. So other than everything we've just been through, which is the most foundational part, some other things that can be helpful to help support aligning your circadian rhythm is, you know, aside from the morning, the light and dark cues, are managing stress, because cortisol elevations impact the circadian rhythm, because as you know now, cortisol is a integral part of the circadian rhythm. We'll talk about stress next week more so, and I have another episode on cortisol specifically, which is I can't remember what number it is, but if you flick through the previous episodes, you will see it in the title. Avoid things at night that are too activating. So exercise, the intense exercise, anything more than a walk, for example, can be too activating, too cortisol inducing at the time of day when we want cortisol to be at its lowest. Stressful conversations, arguments, discussing finances at night when, you know, it's just triggering. It's going to trigger the fight or flight response. Whatever it might be, discussions about the wedding that you're planning, anything at all, talking to children about, you know, your parents about just stressful things. All of this stuff happening at night just isn't helpful. So if there are other times you can plan for these conversations, that would be more ideal. Watching thrillers, like me, watching stuff about serial killers, are literally like on the edge of my seat, or, you know, just stuff that makes me have dreams of serial killers is not good. Any kind of arguments, of course, we want to avoid those at all times anyway, because who likes arguments? But at nighttime, you know, these things are way too activating. Then delaying caffeine in the morning, but delaying when you have your first cup of, whether it's coffee or black tea or green tea. So research is starting to show that delaying caffeine intake for the first 90 minutes of waking can support your natural cortisol awakening response, that rise of cortisol that we've called the CAR that should happen first within an hour of waking. So caffeine increases cortisol, but we want this to happen naturally rather than by a stimulant like caffeine. We want it to be, you know, otherwise it's just a full sense of energy that, you know, we may feel works for us, but essentially it's just a full sense of energy that over time is a stimulant. It's just going to really impact our energy in other ways, particularly that kind of afternoon slump in the afternoon. So we want to naturally induce that cortisol awakening response in the morning so that we don't need caffeine to get us going. If we have caffeine, for example, after the first 90 minutes of waking, we have it because we love it and we enjoy it and we just really want to enjoy this espresso or latte or whatever it might be, or your cup of black tea. So waiting until the CAR has happened before putting any caffeine in can really help. If you currently have caffeine as soon as you wake up, you could try this, let's say, for a week or so and just see if it makes any difference to your sleep, to your energy throughout the day. Just see, like, after a week, do I feel differently? Am I sleeping better? Is my energy better throughout the day? Am I having those slumps that I normally have? Just, is my mood better? Am I just feeling generally more balanced? And then there you go. You know that it would be helpful for you to follow this little rule. It can also be helpful to avoid having any caffeine after 11 a.m. because caffeine can stay in our system for up to 12 hours and impact that lowering of cortisol that should happen by nighttime, leading to less melatonin being made. So even though we may think it doesn't impact our ability to sleep, it might be that it just is impacting our ability to make enough melatonin at night, and we could be having a much better, much more restorative sleep. And we just don't realize it. So again, it's just something to try out. If you are someone who has caffeine after 11 a.m., just do a week or two and see, does it make a difference? Finish dinner a minimum of 2 hours before your usual bedtime. It takes energy to digest food, so this can keep cortisol up and disrupt our sleep quality. So I'm sure you all know, you know, when we have this big gluttonous takeaway late at night, or go to a restaurant late at night, you know, your food isn't served until 9 o'clock or whatever, and then you come home, it's really hard to fall into a good sleep, and we tend to wake up in the morning feeling a bit rough. You know, whether we've had alcohol or not, we can just feel that sort of food hangover, and that's just because of the energy it takes to digest food. The body can't do both. It's not going to have a good night's sleep and digest food. It's going to do one or the other, and it will prioritize digesting your food over actually having a good night's sleep. So food timing is one of the biggest factors in regulating cortisol or regulating the circadian rhythm. So if we can eat all of our meals within daylight hours, closer to waking and further from sleeping at night, it's better. So some people who are very keen on delaying their breakfast, they, you know, they don't have their first meal of the day until, say, 12 o'clock, and then they eat in a window of, say, up to sort of 8 or 9 p.m. at night, it would ideally be better to switch that, move that all further earlier on. So to eat sort of within an hour or so of waking up in the morning and then finish earlier, if, you know, as much as is realistically possible. I can't realistically finish my dinner before 7:30 without finishing my workday much earlier so that I can prepare the dinner, you know, do all the things that need to be done around dinner time, clean the kitchen and stuff like that. So the earliest I've managed to bring dinner forward for me is actually, it was 7 o'clock, actually 7:30. Seven o'clock is the earliest, and that is what I do aim for every night, to have it finished by seven, because I do tend to go to bed around nine. So for me, that's my 2 hours before my usual bedtime where my food can be digested. So if we can eat our meals within that, like I said, within daylight hours, closer to waking, further from sleeping at night, it's better. And that impacts energy, body weight, so many things, as well as the circadian rhythm. And then going to bed and getting up at the same time 7 days a week is really helpful. Most people don't, you know, so many of us don't do this. I never, ever used to do this. I've only started doing this in the last few years. You know, how many of us, we get up, we go to bed at a certain time and get up, wake up at a certain time throughout the week because we have to, let's say, for our work, for our commute or whatever it might be. And then at the weekends, how many of us stay up, you know, 3 hours past our normal bedtime during the week, and then again sleep in the next day a few hours, you know, give or take, obviously depending what your lifestyle is, whether you have kids waking you up or not. But, you know, it's really common for people to essentially go into this kind of like jet lag situation at the weekend because they're just adjusting their sleep wake cycle so differently at the weekend. But going to bed and getting up at the same time 7 days a week, no matter what, is really, really helpful to keep that circadian rhythm in good sync. And optimizing your evening meal. So many women skip their carbohydrates at night. They just think, right, you know, I can't eat carbs at night. I'm just going to go to bed and it's going to make me fat. So they just don't have their carbs in the evening. But actually, this can lead to low blood sugar in the night that then wakes us up. So if we're waking up around 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, it could be a few different things. But one of the things could be low blood sugar waking us up, because it's a stressor. So it's going to increase cortisol to try and get that blood sugar regulated again. So that's going to wake us up. So it's helpful to have a small portion, about one closed fist size, of complex carbohydrates alongside a protein with your vegetable-based dinner. So a good portion of protein, a fist-sized portion of complex carbohydrates, lots of lovely fibrous vegetables. So your complex carbohydrates could be some sweet potatoes, some quinoa, some baby new potatoes, some brown rice, some buckwheat pasta or buckwheat noodles, whatever that might be. And that is going to be supportive of keeping your blood sugar levels stable throughout the night. It's also helpful actually for the production of serotonin, which is a brain chemical that stimulates the production of melatonin. So a couple of good reasons to make sure you are having a healthy portion of carbohydrates with your dinner. Now, cold water exposure first thing in the morning, whether it's in the shower or you're one of these people that has a cold like bath thing in your garden. I am one of those people. Yes, I'm sorry to say. I did buy into it when Lumi, that's the brand that I use. I absolutely love it. And I bought it. My partner thought I was absolutely insane, but he used to watch me every morning jump into this like bath of freezing cold water. And I bought it in January. I think it was like January the 5th. So he thought I was absolutely crazy. But 6 months later, he's now tried it out for himself and he literally cannot stop. He just loves his early morning cold water plunge. So cold water exposure can also just help to increase that cortisol awakening response in the morning naturally, you know, not the way that caffeine can. So you can just switch your shower to cold for at least 60 seconds or so. Or like I say, you know, if you want to do the crazy thing and invest in an ice bath and you have the outdoor space, and that could be something that you might want to do as well. But, you know, the most important thing is the daylight exposure and all of the nighttime sort of wind down routine, the dim lights and all of the other things that I was talking about. I think cold water exposure will kind of be the icing on the cake later down the line. So some supplements that can support sleep. My favorite supplements for nervous system and sleep support, and also for helpful for hot flushes and night sweats if you're suffering with those, are magnesium glycinate, taurine and glycine. So as a trio, taken together around bedtime, within the sort of hour or so before bed, these three perimenopause essentials, this essential trio of glycine, taurine and magnesium glycinate, can work wonders for your sleep. They work on the nervous system. They also impact other important processes like liver detoxification as well. So really helpful for that too. Magnesium sprays can be used, or Epsom salt baths, which contain magnesium sulfate. So you can soak magnesium in through your skin. Having an Epsom salt bath or a football bath, that's a great way to relax as well as getting more magnesium into your skin. Remove or have much less alcohol. So alcohol reduces the amount of time that we spend in that REM sleep, the rapid eye movement sleep, which is actually the most restorative phase of sleep. And it also wreaks havoc on your blood sugar regulation. It can cause blood sugar lows that wake us up in the night. So it can be very disruptive to sleep. You know, we can say things like, oh, I knock out after a couple of glasses of wine, but how restorative is that sleep? I think we all know, even our, you know, these days after just one glass of red wine, for example, I would wake up feeling pretty groggy the next day. And for me personally, for many reasons with inside perimenopause, for me personally, alcohol just isn't worth it at all. So I just haven't had any alcohol now for about 3 or 4 years. And I do find that I am so much happier without it. And I still do all the things that I would have done before, just do it all very sober. So, you know, even if you do manage, as I said, to sleep through the night, after a few drinks, your sleep just won't be as restorative due to that lack of REM, the REM phase sleep. And research shows as well that it takes an average of 5 days for the body to recover from the effects of alcohol, which can also mean sleep quality can take that long to come back. And then if you drink again within those 5 days that it might take, I mean, that's an average, so give or take a few on either side. But if you drink again within that time that your body's still trying to recover from the effects, it's just prolonging that recovery time, and maybe you never have the recovery at all. So one glass, one drink is likely fine, but if you're having more frequently, then it's probably not helpful. It's usually not worth it, but obviously only you can decide that. So I hope you found this episode helpful. We have actually been through quite a lot of things there, but the main take-home message that I want to leave you with is the light and dark cues. The alignment of your circadian rhythm is so, so important now more than ever. And if all you take away from this episode is getting out into daylight first thing in the morning, or using the 10,000 lux full spectrum light box in the morning and seeing how that makes a difference, I would just be so happy. And I'd love to hear from you as well, if you've had any differences from any improvements from anything that we've talked about today. So feel free to drop me an email or message me on Instagram. My details will be in the show notes. So that's it for today, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye-bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.